Welcome to Past, Present and Future. I'm Russell Hearn, and this is the first in a series of interviews with some of the key figures in the EMDR community. It's a delight to be able to start this series with a man who's been actively involved in EMDR UK for over 20 years. He's a training facilitator, consultant, a child and adolescent consultant. He's been an active member of the board for many years and has represented the UK on the European board and the practice committee. He was former chair of the C&A committee for 7 years and has recently stepped into the role as president. It's a pleasure to introduce you to Mike O'Connor. Hi, Mike.
Hi there, Russell.
Mike, I'd like to talk to you about your new role and the present and the future in a moment, if we could. But can we start by going back to that EMDR journey that started for you back in, I think, 1996, when you were unexpectedly thrown into a local disaster that really shook the world? That was, of course, the Dunblane shootings. Despite all your experience at the time, that must have been still a very daunting job and a very daunting experience to be working with those families which had experienced such an awful trauma and were still so fresh in their minds.
Well, you're certainly right to say it was a daunting experience. It certainly was that, amongst other things, including a very steep learning curve for me and some of my colleagues that worked together in that context. I worked in that area as an educational psychologist, and I was a member of what was known as the Critical Incident Assistance Team. As it happened, many of the key officials in the local government were not actually present in the area when the event happened. They were actually in Westminster Parliament. The reason for that was, on the day of the shootings, the local government in Scotland was being completely reorganised, and the formalities had to be completed in Westminster. And that meant that the chief executives, the heads of service and so on, had to be present in Parliament. And so the emergency plan wasn't enacted in the way that it should have been because key people were not present. And of course, this was the time of pagers rather than mobile phones, which I just remembered. And what it meant was that my colleagues and I, as psychologists, were intended to be there to support frontline staff who had to deal with the situation. But because of the fact that it involved very young children, the police immediately turned to us as psychologists to advise them. So literally within an hour of the event happening, I actually was called to attend the school, although I wasn't told why, only that there had been an incident. And it wasn't until I got there that I was briefed by the police, and I then learned what had happened. And basically, my life changed from that point because what happened immediately was I was escorted into the school. I think it was about 50 yards, but I had to actually enter a police van to be escorted right into the school premises. And along with a colleague who's also involved in the EMDR UK, Alison Russell, we were asked to join the parents who were in the staff room of the school. And in fact, we spent the rest of the day with the parents as they waited to be told what had happened to their children. And that was an extremely distressing experience because gradually the parents learned that their children had been killed. There had been a sense of hope in the room when we first entered, and that slowly diminished over time. So that was the context. And then from there, I was asked to be involved in lots of different roles, some of which I'd never done before, including radio interviews, TV interviews as a spokesperson for the council. We had to produce psychoeducation materials urgently, and we had to meet with parents of the different classes in the school to, in effect, do a bit of debriefing with them and also to inform them as to what the council were doing to support them. And that all happened within probably the space of just a few days. A bit later, I then became a member of a specialist team, and that led to me working in the community for the following 3.5 years.
That's a considerable time, isn't it? How did that affect you professionally?
Well, the immediate impact of the event was we all felt de-skilled. The enormity of what happened just felt overwhelming for all of us. And it took us some time and a lot of discussion amongst each other to realize that we did have the skills to help because we had been using these skills for years. And so we just had to confirm with each other and ourselves that, yes, we could actually help. We were experienced in working with children. We were experienced in working therapeutically. That said, we had to learn a lot of new skills. And because we were a group of people who did not come from the community, we had to establish credibility. And we did that by performing all sorts of practical tasks, like checking mail for parents, because there were masses of things sent to the community by well-meaning people from around the world. Teddy bears, flowers, trees, letters, most of which were very supportive, but some that were not. And one of the things I learned in that situation is that in these circumstances, you get all sorts of people with extreme views. And so some people would write to say it was God's will that the child had been murdered. Our job was to intervene and prevent that kind of mail reaching parents. So that was the kind of things we had to do to establish credibility with people in the community.
And EMDR seemed to come along quite timely for you at that point. Is that right?
Well, yes. I had never heard of EMDR when I started to work in Dunblane. And what I didn't say, actually, I actually went to school in Dunblane. I actually spent 8 years of my school career in Dunblane, so it was an odd experience to go back in such different circumstances. But going back to EMDR, there was a clinical psychologist who worked in the area, who knew about EMDR, and basically she organised a training under the HAP organisation. And so a small group of us began our EMDR training. I think we had to go to Belfast for the part one training, as it was. And subsequently, we completed part two training, I did in London, and also was trained to work with children. Bob Tinker and his then wife, Sandra Wilson, came across to Scotland and worked with a group of about six or seven of us to learn how to use EMDR with children. So we were very fortunate to have that experience. When I think about it now, I realised that, and I didn't say that, I ended up working in the community of Dunblane for 3 years, but I didn't work there full time. I worked there part time with what turned out to be my new employer. And partly because of my involvement with the events in Dunblane, colleagues in schools in the area where I worked began to refer young people to me who had experienced loss and trauma. As a result of the shootings in Dunblane, many children and young people were triggered. They had experienced other losses and traumas, the kind of events that never make the headlines. I think of a girl who one morning got up for school, went downstairs and found her grandmother dead on the sofa. And then what it helped me realize it sensitized me to the fact that trauma and loss happen all the time, every day of the week. But mostly we just don't hear about it. We hear about the big events, but we don't hear about the everyday events. And that led me, together with my colleague Alison Russell, to set up a loss and trauma service in the community where I was working part-time. That service continued for the next 15 years. We got funding from different sources, including the Scottish Government, but other sources, such as the Big Lottery Fund. It changed my role because then my job was entirely working with loss and trauma, providing therapy directly to children and families, but also through training activities. Alison and myself did lots of training on loss and trauma within education settings and for volunteer organisations. We trained in a programme called Seasons for Growth, a grief education programme, which is very relevant for the situation we find ourselves in today. We did some research on the prevalence of trauma. We were part of a project where we surveyed 820 schools in Scotland to look at the prevalence of trauma, and then did a local project and discovered that in the schools that we surveyed, 98% of the children reported at least one trauma in their life. About two-thirds reported a family bereavement. One-third reported a breakup of their family and so on. So the whole event in Dunblane led to us being much more sensitive to the awareness of trauma and to think about what we could do to actually support children and their families who had experienced such trauma and loss in their lives.
And I'm guessing from that, you know, with the, with those high numbers of children experiencing trauma, EMDR is really important to be able to work with them at an early stage.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes me think about, you know, the importance of using EMDR with children. I mean, now we know, and I've known for the last 15 years about adverse childhood events and the impact that these have on people's physical health, mental health, and emotional well-being. And so what's really, I think, helpful about EMDR in children is you can actually prevent a lot of suffering later in life by helping them resolve the trauma as early as possible. And the other thing I think about EMDR is children get it. They really do. You just embrace it. And partly because of that, it's generally very effective with them. As you'll know, Russell, that if you don't get it right, children just tell you. And so you just have to adapt and learn as you go along when you make mistakes. Yeah, so that's why I think it's so important that we use EMDR with children and young people.
And did you find that training at that time, did that mean that the way that you approach the support for that community changed considerably?
I suppose it did. Thinking back on it, there were very few people who had actually been trained in EMDR in Scotland. But because we had been trained, obviously we wanted to use it with people who turned up at our centre, because we established a support centre in the heart of the community, and people would turn up. And once we had established credibility with them by doing lots of practical things, then they were open to then receive psychological help and support from us. And that included families who had been immediately involved in the situation in that their child had been in the school at the time or had been injured or in some cases had been killed. And it seemed appropriate to begin to use EMDR. And I should say that we have lots of support from the EMDR community around the world, because obviously you don't generally start your EMDR journey with working with really complex cases with people who have experienced extreme trauma. Mm. But the support included actually Francine Shapiro responding to faxes sent by some of my colleagues seeking advice and support for some of the work that we were doing. And I mentioned faxes, of course, because none of us had mobile phones at that time. So we used fax machines.
Can you think of a specific case or time when it became evident to you that you were really dealing with something very powerful?
Yeah, there were several experiences of that happening. A colleague had asked me to see this little boy. She had been working with him for 2 years using play therapy, but things had become stuck, and she wasn't trained at that time in EMDR. I agreed to meet with him. And interestingly, when I think back on it, he was very happy to meet with me on his own. His parents brought him, but it helped that his previous therapist knew me. He was able to kind of vouch for me. He produced a remarkable series of drawings, right through to the point where he was well on the road to recovery and felt safe for the first time in yeah. 2 years. He never uttered a word during the EMDR. I asked him to draw if he wanted to. He didn't have to speak and tell me what happened, and that was his choice. But it was evident from his facial expressions and suddenly bodily gestures that he actually was processing. And he was able to return to sleep in his own bed in his own room. I mean, it was remarkable. That was over a period of 10 weeks. And that certainly demonstrated to me that the power of EMDR. In contrast to that, there was also a woman in her mid-50s who turned up at the support centre in a very distressed state. She felt deeply ashamed that she was coming forward for help, but was desperate. She was suicidal. Now, it turned out that she had moved to the community of Dunblane 20 years earlier following the death of our four-year-old child in a drowning. And the events in Dunblane had triggered that memory, which she had never actually resolved. She had never grieved for her child, partly because she was in a very abusive relationship and had lots of other children. And I used EMDR with her to great effect. And not only was she able to grieve for her lost child, she also processed a childhood rape. She had been raped as a young girl. And she had, in quotes, forgotten about it. And in the course of EMDR, she had recalled that event and was able to process that. What I remember in particular is that when she had been assaulted, her assailant had actually pinned her down with her own bicycle so she couldn't move. And during the course of my contact with her, she had to attend hospital because she had a heart condition. And as she was being assessed, she had to climb onto a bicycle so they could check her heart rate. And she recounted this to me with great delight that she was able to climb onto a bicycle without the fear that she had always had about bicycles. These are two examples. There's many others, but these two that I can remember that stick in my memory.
And you've certainly been very proficient and an important role model, really, in shaping the Child and Adolescent Committee over so many years, for which we're very thankful. Now that your role is taking you into the presidency, and I'm just wondering what your experiences and your background, how that was all sort of coming together to give you a drive and maybe a vision for EMDR UK now.
Well, one of the things we have to do is to learn to embrace the prospect of online working, or remote working, for the foreseeable future. I mean, we have already started that, and we have provided webinars for members to access. But there's more than that needs to happen. We have to be mindful of the fact that in the immediate and longer term, we're going to have an upsurge in mental health issues amongst the general population, as well as specific populations such as NHS staff. So we need to think creatively about how we can address these issues. And I think what's so important is that we have to address them as an EMDR community. And we really have to try and work together as a community of therapists to find the best ways and the most effective ways of supporting people. There are signs of that already happening. People have been very generous in actually sharing their skills and their experience and their time to support other people in the EMDR community. And as a board, we need to do more work on that. We are actively looking at ways that we can do that. An example being, you know, finding EMDR consultants who would be prepared to offer pro bono supervision to clinicians working with frontline staff. That's something that's underway at the moment, and we need to expand that as one example. One of the things that people will be thinking about is how can they continue with their CPD activities in the current climate. Already we have relaxed the rules about that, and it's now possible for people to have CPD points if they join in remote training events. How long we need to be doing that for is not clear, but for the time being, the accreditation committee are very open to accepting online EMDR training CPD events for the foreseeable future. A bigger question and a bigger issue is about the provision of EMDR training, because at the moment there is no training in EMDR happening in the UK and in Europe. And it's an issue that EMDR Europe are currently addressing, but we don't have any decision about that yet. But that's a very important issue for the EMDR community. For example, people who are partway through their training, you know, how are they going to complete that training when there isn't any at the moment? The question is it possible to replicate EMDR training remotely? It's clear that parts of the EMDR training could be delivered remotely. The biggest issue and concern is how do you replicate the practicums? All I can say at this point is that EMDR Europe are actively considering that. They've already had requests from EMDR UK to consider a pilot project or a trial to see if it's possible to maintain the highest standards of training via a remote platform.
And with that, of course, you've got the conference that we sadly had to cancel, but is now kind of has now been resurrected.
Yes, and that's going to be an interesting experience. Our very first virtual annual conference, that's well in hand, and it's going to be a mixture of live streaming and also pre-recorded presentations by different people. It's going to be a new experience for all of us, but we have actually invested in having a professional technician who's going to help guide us through that to make sure it's a very professional conference. So I'm both looking forward to it, if not slightly anxious about this new format.
And was I right in thinking that if there was any profits, they'd be going to EMDR charities as well?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that yet. It's quite possible. I mean, we already support other charities, mainly Trauma Aid UK, but also the Trauma Response Network. And it may well be that that's what the board decide. I don't want to speak on behalf of the board about what we do with it. And the reason I hesitate is that one of the pressing issues for us is about research. We know that we need to conduct more RCTs. That's a very expensive business. And so we need to look at ways that we can identify funds and funding sources that would allow us to complete the RCTs that we really urgently have to begin to undertake.
So is that one of the key roles that you'll be taking forward now as we think to the future?
Yes, literally, we are actively considering that and how we might find access to funding that would allow us to undertake RCTs. Of course, the thing is, you can't suddenly magic up RCTs. They take quite a bit of time. And so we're presently considering how we can best do that. But beyond that, I think there's a wider issue, which is that I think we've gotten to the point as an organization where we have almost 4,000 members that we need to review what we actually do. And so one of the things we'll be discussing at the next board meeting is about undertaking a strategic review of the business of EMDR UK. So that's not underway yet, but it probably would have been underway if not for the current circumstances we find ourselves involved in.
So I was wondering, Mike, when you came to the presidency, I know that you kind of inherit some of these ongoing issues, the need for us to create more research to prove the effectiveness of EMDR for other organisations. But I wondered if there was a dream or an ambition or a desire that you had to kind of mark your presidency.
I think for me, what is important is that we recognise that we rely a great deal on the time given to the association by people, which is on a voluntary basis. And when I first joined the board, we probably had about 200 members. We now have almost 4,000. And that creates challenges about how you manage that, how you are able to engage with your membership in a way that they find meaningful. And I think for me, my vision for the future is that much of the business of EMDR UK can be conducted in a way that's not so reliant on volunteers. Because these same volunteers have lots of skills, lots of experience, which they could use to contribute, and they do contribute to the development of EMDR. But there may be some things that we do as individual members of the board that could actually be taken over and done in, I was going to say, in a professional way. I don't mean in any way to suggest that what people do is not professional. I mean in the sense that as organizations become larger, you have to look at your structures, and there might be more effective and more efficient ways we can conduct our business than we're doing at the present. Because largely we have the same structure as we had when there were far fewer members.
So that would be your kind of goal then, to bring in this more stable structure to prepare the organization for maybe the next 20 years.
One of the things I'm very impressed about is the reach that EMDR Italy have. And what's really interesting about EMDR Italy is they are consulted by national government, by regional government, and by local government. And they've had, in the last few months, 177 requests for their direct involvement from these members of either local or regional or national government. And my vision, I suppose, is that maybe at some point in the not-too-distant future, then EMDR UK will have the same impact and will be consulted in the same way. We're nowhere near there yet, but I think it's something important that we should aspire to.
And on that message, Mike, I'd like to say thank you on behalf of everyone who has heard your story, the long journey that it's been, and wish you every success with your presidency.
Thank you.
Past, Present and Future is a Laura Beach production for EMDR UK.